I'm pleased to present an audio recording of the workshop on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali that I presented on Saturday, August 19th, 2017. In this session, we covered Sutras 1 through 5 of Chapter 1. I hope you enjoy the discussion, and I would love to hear from you with your comments or feedback. Keep the spine comfortably tall, upright, relaxed arms and shoulders. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. Start with the invocation to Sage Patanjali. You can either keep the eyes closed and listen in, or you can read on the screen or chant along with me if you like it. Inhale. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena Yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Softly open the eyes, and Vijay, you can read the English translation loud.
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, means sages. He has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda of language, through his treatise on grammar, Patanjala Maha. And the impurities of the chitta, mind field, through his treatise on yoga, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
Very good. So that's about Patanjali. He is credited with these three sciences: science of health and medicine, Ayurveda, science of cleansing the speech, grammar. He is the most referenced commentator on the grammar by Panini. Panini was the original author of the Sanskrit grammar, and his explanation, his commentary on that grammar is the most authentic and most well-read, widely read. So he is the sort of the father of grammar also. And of course, to purify the mind, he gave us yoga. Okay, so that's what we are going to be talking about. Are you joining us here? Okay, then you may have to bring chairs. Thank you. And if you don't mind, can you bring one more pair?
Sure.
so that if people join in late, okay. Yeah. Well, somebody was sitting there. You can sit at the back. Yeah. Okay, so namaste, and let me welcome everybody. Like I said, this is the first session of this new series of sessions on the Yoga Sutras. We finished the last one last month, and like I said, that round took us about a little over a year and a half, I remember. So usually that's about the time it's going to take us. But this time again, we are going to go through sutra by sutra. Okay? That means we'll take one sutra at a time, learn how to recite the sutra in Sanskrit, and there'll be a test at the end of, you know. So just learn how to recite the sutra, and then we'll go through meanings of the sutra one word at a time. We try to understand every word in the sutra.
What is sutra means? What is the word sutra means?
Sutra means, we'll come to that, just one second. Let me explain the overall concept. Yeah. So that's what we're going to do, sutra by sutra. And the text has four chapters, where we're not going to go through in a complete sequence. As you've noticed, I break into segments based on the topic. And it's the topic which, in my opinion, is more sequential than what Patanjali has presented. He has, of course, his own reasons why he did that, but for our understanding, I have broken the sequence into my own understanding. So it'll be a different sequence. The word sutra means a thread. Sutra means a thread. So Yoga Sutra means it's a thread which is connecting all these yoga statements together. All right. So it's called the Yoga Sutra. Sutras has multiple meanings. Sutra also means link. Okay. So in that sense, it's a link which connects all these statements together. And in this text, there are four chapters and a total of 195 sutras. 195. There's a few texts which give an additional sutra in chapter 3, so it makes it 196. But most people believe it's that one was added for some reason. It's no explanation. So what are the four chapters? The first chapter is called, yes?
Parasamadhi.
Hmm?
Parasamadhi.
Samadhi Pada. Yeah. Samadhi Pada. That's the first chapter. It talks about the concept of yoga, talks about defining yoga, what's the definition of yoga, and also what are the goals of yoga, and the final goal of yoga is to reach the state of mind which is called samadhi. So it's called samadhi pada, and there are multiple stages to that samadhi which he describes in detail. The second chapter is called sadhana pada. Sadhana means the technique, methodology, etc. That's the meaning of the word sadhana. What's the methodology of achieving the goals of yoga? In that chapter, the first thing he starts out with, in the very beginning, he starts out with defining what is stress. The term that Patanjali uses for stress is klesha. That's the Sanskrit term, which means pain, suffering, afflictions, etc., etc. But the modern term, most people understand stress much better than anything else. Okay, so think of it as stress. So what is stress? What causes stress? And then finally, he he goes into this discussion of the eight limbs of yoga, which he says is the means that he recommends that you apply these eight limbs of yoga to get rid of that stress and make the mind very peaceful and calm. So that's the next chapter. The third chapter is called the Vibhutipada. Vibhuti means supernormal attainments that you can get as a result of the practice of yoga. And these are attainments like anything, you know, you can fly, you can walk on water, you know, all those things which are science fiction, but they, according to Patanjali, they can be made real if you have a very intense practice of yoga. Okay, seeing through walls and all kinds of stuff, feeling light, feeling heavy, feeling very powerful, feel very small, big, whatever you want, basically, he says you can attain that through the intense practice of yoga. And when I say yoga, he implies meditation. Okay? See, intense practice of meditation is required to achieve anything in yoga. See? Then the fourth chapter is called the Kaivalya Pada. Kaivalya is the name given by Patanjali to that state of the mind where you have attained full, complete freedom, full self-realization, understanding of who you are, understanding your true identity. And when you have attained that state, he calls that state Kaivalya. So in the chapter 4, he talks a little more in depth about Kaivalya and, you know, different aspects of the stages of the mind that you will help you get there eventually. Okay? So that's all about the kind of the very broad overall structure of the sutras. Alright? And now that everyone is here, before we proceed, we always go through introductions. Okay? So that people will tell their first name, last name, and what made you come for this class. All right, so we'll start with Vijaya.
Okay. My name is Vijaya Chadran. I work at DIG, and of course research. But I just try to make sense of things I see every day, and it's some really get to me, and some leaves me with a lot of thoughts. So I just want to make sense of all those thoughts. And also main thing is to learn, I think. Learning is never a bad thing, even if it's whatever the topic. So
good. Thank you.
I'm Kathy Condis, and this is, I think, my third round through. And so hopefully I will learn even more things.
Thank you, Kathy.
Sandesh Joshi, and I started the journey on yoga with meditation course, I think 2-3 months ago.
About 3 months ago,
But I mean, I've been interested in more, and I realized over time the power of mind, and so it's something very interested in learning how, what yoga sutras have to say.
Very good. Welcome. Dave
McGovern. I'm just interested in studying the original text, what's in it, and because many people think yoga is just the asana practice.
Right.
Maybe pranayama, but there's much more to it, and I want to learn.
Wonderful. Great. Jessica.
My name is Jessica Shepherd. I've been coming here for a while, and recently I've been going to yoga a lot, so I feel like I need to know more about why I'm going. I love it so much.
Okay.
But, I want to know more. I've been wanting to.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Jayanti Murugan. Mainly I came here for the stress relief and calm my mind, so that's the main purpose.
Good.
Yeri Lalgunder, I think I started last year, a little over a year yoga with you. So.
And took a break in between. Good. Welcome back.
Thank you. Wanted to, you know, obviously learn the original text, you know, what Patanjali says. So this is a good opportunity, you know, without going through the reading.
That cannot be avoided. You have to read eventually.
There's going to be homework.
I can only give you a very high-level bird's-eye view. If you really want to understand these texts, you have to dive into them and really dig deep into them. It's not easy.
I am Kalpana Satyavolu. I came to your last few classes of the last session, but now that you're starting the whole, I want to start afresh, and I'm very interested to learn about all this because I feel like I can get closer to the Indian culture and a little bit about our philosophies and everything. That's why I want to learn Sanskrit, and I really want to get into this. Finally, I've got the time in my life to do this. So I'm happy.
Good.
Thank you.
Wonderful. And Kalpana?
My name is Srinivas, and this is the second round of Yoga Sutra.
Yes.
Each round is, again, new experience and new learning. I'd like to explore more and more.
Good. Nilesh.
My name is Nilesh Asher. This is I've been on and off on the series over the last 3 years. But the reason I come back is that when we are doing the asanas or when we are doing even meditation and pranayama, we are doing only some aspects of it. And I really was interested in learning more about the philosophy which ties everything together. And I've still not gotten that. I may not get it in this lifetime, but I have to keep trying. So I keep coming back to just understand more of that link between all of them.
Very good.
I'm Veena, his mother, and I come from India. I used to go to yoga class every day over there.
Wow.
And since last, it's about 17 years. But knowledge never ends, so I've come to know something more.
Thank you. Welcome. Wonderful. So glad that you're all here. All right. So, like I mentioned, you know, we'll start from chapter 1. And we'll go sutra by sutra, one by one at a time. Pick the words and then understand each word in each sutra. And then see what sense we can make out of all those things. All right? So let's see where we go from here. Oh, that's another problem. Okay. So this is the first sutra. So what we've been doing is, I'll read out one word at a time and you will repeat after me. Okay? Atha. Yoga Anushasanam. Atha. Yoga Anushasanam. The full sentence is Atha Yoga Anushasanam. All right. The English translation, now the most, 90% of these translations, maybe a little more, maybe, they are all from the text by Swami Sachidananda. So I have used that at that time when I did these translations. That was handy, so I just copied those texts. Okay? It doesn't matter which one, you just need one reference. So his translation is, here now is the exposition or the discipline of yoga. The word Atha is an important word here because Atha represents now, at this very moment. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you the Anushasana. Anushasana means discipline or understanding or the knowledge of yoga. Yoga Anushasana means the Anushasana or the discipline or the knowledge of yoga. I'm going to provide you that now. Now, the commentators, you know, they always get into deep of these words. They say Atha is a very important word. Why is it important? Few things it signifies. Firstly, it signifies now. Now means they say that it must be that these students who he is addressing, they must have been with him for a long time, and Patanjali has prepared them up to this point with other knowledge, which is essential to make them ready to understand the yoga philosophy. So first of all, it represents that these students have qualified, so to say, okay, to become students of yoga now. Secondly, it also implies that I, as the teacher, I'm qualified to teach you. So I have the ability, the authority, and the qualification to impart this knowledge to you. It also implies that this now is the very auspicious, very right moment when you want to learn about yoga, for whatever reason he said that. So these are some of the things that the commentators, you know, comment on the word artha. Okay? So artha, yoga anushasanam. Anushasanam means shas, it comes from the word shas. Shas means to control, to
govern.
Yes, shas means to govern, to control. Shasanam is governing. Anushasanam changes the meaning slightly. It means discipline. It means, any topic that you want to go into depth in something, that's called anushasanam. So if you want to study the yoga in depth, then it means anushasanam of yoga. Okay? Now coming to the word yoga. Yoga comes from the ancient, from the root, every Sanskrit word, or most of them, are derived from root words. The word in Sanskrit has a root word. The root word for yoga is
yuj.
Yuj. Y-U-J. Okay? Yuj. Let me see if I can, or maybe I can. Everyone can see that also, right? Yes, so maybe I can do that. Instead of switching screens. So, yoga, it comes from yuj, Y-U-J. Now, if you look at the dictionary, if you go to the Sanskrit dictionary, the word yuj has multiple meanings, upwards of 30 meanings, minor variations here and there. The two meanings that are most important for our purposes, one is the one which is normally used in most explanations. So when you ask somebody, you know, if you ask a yoga instructor, for example, what does yoga mean to you? What's the common answer?
Union.
Union of what?
Body and soul.
Body and soul.
Body and the soul. Mind, body and soul, that's what they say, right? So yoga, most common understanding is it's the union of mind, body and soul. And then it stops there. Because then they have no explanation as to what that means. They will just say that it's the union of mind, body and soul. And if I ask them to explain what that means, well, just union. You know, you have a combination of mind and body and then you combine it with the soul. What does that mean? First of all, to understand all these things, you have to understand what the body is, what the mind is, and what the soul is. Otherwise, you have no way of joining together. Does everyone get that? To understand something, the union of mind, body, and soul, you have to understand what the soul is, what the mind is, what the body is. So, it becomes a kind of incomplete understanding. What is yoga? Yoga is the union of mind, body and soul. And then beyond that, they don't know anything. All right. So here is where I need a digression to understand what soul is. Because we mentioned the word soul, we need to understand what that is. Okay. So this will be a long digression. I hope not too long. Kathy knows this, you know. We go through a digression. Okay. The philosophy of yoga actually is one of the six systems of Indian philosophy. This is a total digression now, okay? So we'll leave this for now. There are six systems of Indian philosophy. Anybody know those six?
Sankhya is
one. Sankhya is one. Very good. What are the others?
Mimamsa
is one. Good.
Yoga
is number three, let's say.
Vaisheshika,
number four. Very good. So these are Nyaya. Let me write this down. Not that it matters, but I'll write them down anyway. So the six systems of Indian philosophy are Nyaya, Vaisheshika, then Sankhya, yoga, then Mimamsa, and Vedanta. Okay. The six systems of India, I'm not going to go into any discussion of these, just to mention the words, because it's good to know that we are talking about two of the philosophies which are a part of these six. Okay. The two that we are most interested in are the Sankhya philosophy and the Yoga philosophy. Why is that so important? Because Yoga by Patanjali is actually based on some of the most basic tenets which comprise the Sankhya philosophy. So whatever are the basic tenets of the Sankhya philosophy, Patanjali used those and built his yoga structure on top of those. The main concept in the Sankhya philosophy which Patanjali has used is that there are two entities which are real, two entities. Real and permanent. What are these two entities? Purusha and Prakriti. Let me write that down again now. So these two entities are Purusha and Prakriti. Now, what are they?
Purusha is the
soul and Prakriti is?
Everything else.
Everything else that is, that we can perceive through our senses or even otherwise. Right? So, this material aspect of our, of the universe, that's called Prakriti, which includes everything that we see, feel, touch, and everything that's a part of this system called the body. All right? So we have the physical body, then we have the mind, then we have the intellect, then we have the memories and all that good stuff. All that is what's called the Prakriti. The main concept here is that Prakriti by itself does not have consciousness. The only thing that has consciousness is Purusha, which is nothing but pure consciousness, pure soul, Atma. And when we say, okay, I'm thinking, how can you think without consciousness? Okay, or I'm making a decision, or I'm moving my hand. You cannot do that without consciousness. So what they claim is that it is the consciousness that gets reflected from the Purusha. So they have to be together, they have to be in close proximity for them to function, for the Prakriti to function. And through that closeness, they get this consciousness functioning through the Prakriti then. It's the proximity of these two that will help us do stuff that we do in our material life. All right. Otherwise, they are not conscious. They don't have any consciousness. Now, bring a chair, please. There is one back there. You can bring that, whichever works for you.
So, quick question. So, if the soul is separated from the Prakriti, then we can't experience it.
If they decided to step away from each other, then we cannot experience Prakriti.
Can you really do that, though? That's the question.
No, we cannot. Yeah. We cannot. We don't have the power to do that. Yeah. But the point of all this philosophy is, according to the Sankhya philosophy, that these two are independent entities. They are not together. They are not joined. They cannot be joined together. The whole purpose of this Sankhya philosophy is that Purusha and Prakriti are two separate entities and they will forever remain so. And then Patanjali used that concept and built his yoga philosophy on top of that, saying that the goal of yoga is to understand that Purusha and Prakriti are separate. They are two separate entities. Right now, the way things are, I am confused. I think that they are together, they are joined somehow, because my ego takes over and I have allowed my ego to become more and more effective, more powerful. And that happens because I don't know my true identity. I am supposed to be my entity as my being as the soul or the Purusha, but I don't know that. I don't know they are separate. I don't know they should be separate. So I think my ego is the boss. So I listen to my ego all the time, you know, and I guess stay miserable. That's it. Stay stressed out throughout. So to say that yoga is the union of mind, body and soul is the ultimate flaw that you can think of from this perspective. Why? Because what Patanjali says, and we'll come to that in chapter 2 in a few months' time, Patanjali very clearly says, it is this union between the Purusha and Prakriti, apparent union, which is the cause of all your suffering, totally. So we have to disengage the two in our mind, in our understanding. Only when we are able to do that, we can stay happy forever. Fat, dumb and happy after that. But that, how long does it take to get there, he says? Many lifetimes. Many lifetimes. Okay. But whatever you attain in this lifetime does not go waste, according to him. It stays in your bank balance, and you start off at the same spot in the next life. So, and that's the reason why we notice that some people, even their skilled children, you know, they are not very stressed out, they are very calm, they are very sharp, they are very intellectual, and, you know, they can work things out. Some, you know, it doesn't matter how much effort they make or you make, they never understand anything. It's all because of their previous karmas that they carry with them. And they must have done something useful in their previous life which makes them, you know, very clear in their thinking. That means they already have made some progress in that direction where they know these things. Who knows? All right. So that's the kind of a background information on how Patanjali has used these main concepts from the Sankhya philosophy. And there are many others, and we'll come to those, some of the other very important concepts from the Sankhya, which Patanjali has used as we go along. Okay? But for the purposes of our understanding of the yoga philosophy, the other meaning of the word yuj that is given in the dictionary is to be in samadhi. In samadhi. That's the other meaning, one of the meanings given. Which is the meaning which is really applicable to us? Not the union meaning. Now, when I say us, or when I say yoga, I will always mean Patanjali's yoga. When I say us, means Patanjali's yoga. Okay. Now, there are other systems of thought. For example, I mentioned that there are other systems like Vedanta philosophy or Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Now, Vedanta does have that concept of union. Because in Vedanta, there are two things. One is called the Brahman. Maybe I shouldn't go there, but then it can get confusing. If you have questions about Vedanta, ask me at the end of the class.
You can just finish off, since you already mentioned Brahman, but just Brahman and Atman and just end it there, right? Because that will be the link here.
Yeah, so, you know, they have another entity called Brahman, which is the supreme consciousness, only one single entity which is real, everything else is unreal, according to that philosophy. And Atma or individual Atma, they say, is nothing but but the supreme consciousness called Brahman. So there's, in a sense, it's not really union, it's the sameness. So in that sense, you can think of it as yoga meaning union in that sense, it's oneness.
So is this Vedanta concept used in the Vedic scriptures?
Yes. In the Upanishads, there is a lot of discussion of the Vedanta concepts. But yoga is different in that sense. Okay? That's why I don't want to bring that, because if you get into Vedanta discussion, we'll get confused with yoga. So let's stay with it.
It'll take us a decade to finish, rather than a year.
Yeah, you know, let's not get there. It gets very confusing. All right, so that's the meaning of the word yoga. Yoga comes from the root word yuj, and for our purposes, for the purposes that we study yoga, yuj means to be in the state of samadhi. What does that mean, in the state of samadhi?
Kaivalya.
Well, kaivalya is a result of samadhi in a sense, in that context. Samadhi is the state of the mind where the mind has become completely one-pointed on a single object, and then it has gone beyond that at some stage. Okay? We'll come to that. Okay? We're doing a lot of discussion on these concepts as we go along. But that's basically what yoga is all about. So when we say Atha Yoga Anushasanam, okay. So here now, I'm going to explain to you this whole discipline or the whole science of yoga. So we understand the individual words now. Atha means here and now, right now, which means I have the authority and the knowledge to teach, you have the qualification to study, and this is the most perfect moment to study yoga in your lifetimes. That's Atha. Anushasanam means the discipline or the understanding or knowledge or the exposition. And yoga means to be eventually in the state of samadhi. Alright? So we can move on now. There is a book by Swami Veda Bharati. That's the name of the author. It's a commentary on the Yoga Sutras. And on this particular sutra, he has spent about 58 pages, if I remember right. This one, sutra number one. 58 pages to explain all this. Okay, so I think this is where, the commentators, you know, they try to explain things so that people understand. And because we are talking of the state of the mind being in a state which is called samadhi, okay, so now, Vyasa happens to be the most authentic and authoritative commentator on the Yoga Sutras. Vyasa, his name was Vyasa. V-Y-A-S-A. Alright, Vyasa. And some people believe that he was a kind of a compatriot, he lived at the same time as Patanjali, and they knew each other, and probably he could read his mind much better than anybody else. So his commentary is supposedly the most authoritative commentary. Okay. Now, he has given, for our understanding of the mind and how the mind goes into different stages or states, he says, think of the mind as being in one of these five states at any given time. He calls them five states. So what are these five states? The first one is called Kshipta in Sanskrit, Kshipta. The second is called Moodha. Kshipta, Moodha. Then Vikshipta is the number three state, Vikshipta. Number four is Ekagra. Ekagra. And number five is Niruddha. Niruddha state. Now, what do these mean? You know, I need another digression here. See, these digressions are important because otherwise you don't understand some of these concepts, right? Now, to understand these five states, you need to understand the concept of three gunas. All right, so that's another digression. Now, we'll be, you know, it's not that if I discuss it today, I will not come back to these things. Anytime we need discussion, I will come back to these discussions, because otherwise people forget. They don't remember these things. So, what are the three gunas and what are they? Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas are the three gunas, right? And what they say is that this prakriti that we talked about, this material aspect of our being, prakriti or nature, you can call it, it's a composite of these three gunas. Everything in nature, everything in prakriti is a composite of these three gunas. Sattva, so these three gunas are, and this is an important topic, so you should try and remember these words. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Now, Sattva represents something that's pure, clean, positive, you know, uplifting and all that good stuff is Sattva. Rajas represents everything that has a lot of action, mobility, ambition, desires, things like that. You know, gung-ho, type A personality, that's all part of the Rajas guna. Then Tamas is all dullness, sleepiness, lethargy. You know, I always like to call it couch potato-ness, where you know all you want to do is to sit down on a Sunday afternoon with a bottle of beer and a bag full of potato chips and watch football and do nothing else. Okay, and that's Tamas. Anybody ever done that? No. And everything in nature is a composite of these three, including our body, including our minds, including any living being, non-living beings, it doesn't matter what it is. All right, now coming to our minds and our being, at any given moment, one of these three gunas is more dominant than the other gunas. One of these three gunas is more dominant. Okay? So, for example, your decision to come here to attend this class, my assumption is at that time Sattva was more dominant.
Rajas.
Sattva and Rajas combination, because Rajas is what brought you here, you had the desire to drive, right? And Sattva is what made you decide that I should go here. That's just an assumption, okay? And at the end of the day, when you're very tired, Tamas takes over, you know, when you want to sleep. Tamas takes over, right? So when you're sitting in meditation, most likely Sattva is more dominant at that time. But when you're sitting and working and then you're thinking, oh my God, when I'm going to get a promotion, that's Rajas working, right? Desire, okay? And when you just suddenly sit down, oh my God, I hate this person, I wish I could slap him, you know, that's a combination of Tamas and Rajas, okay? That thought itself that I should slap him, that's Tamas, negative thought. But the fact that you want to slap him, move the body, and that's Rajas. All right? You get the idea? And anybody read Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavad Gita. So you know that, you know, there's a huge discussion on these three gunas in the Bhagavad Gita. Very, very significant component of the Gita discussion is on the three gunas. The entire chapter, starting with 13, 14, 15, you know, major part of those are dedicated to the discussion on the gunas. Okay? Actually, what
is linked to the doshas?
No, not. They may be, but, you know, since I don't know much of Ayurveda at all, you know, I don't know. There could be. I doubt it, though.
What is doshas?
Hmm? Dosha is an it's term for Ayurveda. They are called Kapha, Pitta and Vata. They are the three doshas. And they also represent individual, you know, one of them may be dominant at a given time. And that's what controls our health and well-being and other aspects of our being, including our mind. So her question is, are they related? And I have no idea. I don't know. Mostly they're related to physical health, not
right.
Doshas. But I don't know. I could be wrong. When you study all that, do let us know. Okay. So sattva, rajas and tamas are the three gunas. Well, I was going to say, you know, since I was studying the Gita and I found this so much discussion on the gunas, what I decided to do was I pulled out all the shlokas that have to do with the gunas and I put it in a document. What it is worth, I have no idea, but if anybody is interested, you're welcome to take it. So I have a document which has listed all the shlokas from the Gita. Of course, I have given chapter numbers and all that, which relate to the discussion of the gunas. It took me a while to do that, but I don't know what to do with it now. But it's good to look at it sometimes. Okay, so why am I talking about the gunas now? Because of the gunas, our behavior pattern changes. Gunas, they work with our subconscious levels, and then they decide what behavior you should do at a given time, what action you should do at a given time. So we are propelled by the gunas to do things that we do. All right, so something in our subconscious comes up, and at that time, let's say, just to take a silly example, that you had a fight with somebody some time ago, okay? And suddenly that thought of that fight comes up in your from your subconscious, it comes to your surface, active mind, as they call it. Now, depending on the guna active at that time, your action will depend on that. So if tamas was active at that time and you suddenly come up with the thought, oh my God, this guy gave me so much hell last time, and you know, then your tamas will say, it's okay, you know, let's forget about it. Just not bother, you know. I'm not going to do anything, I'm just too lazy. That's tamas. If rajas was active at that time, then the moment that thought comes, I have to take revenge. I am going to do this. I am going to slap the guy. I am going to kill the guy. I am going to get my gun out and shoot him next time I see him. If sattva was dominant at that time, you will start thinking positively. How can I make friends with the guy? How can I maybe help him get better? How can I make him forget things? You know, so you kind of get a flavor for what I'm talking about. Depending on which guna is dominant at a given time, your actions will depend on that based on the same input that you receive in your mind. And it could be input not just from the mind, I'm saying from the five senses you can receive an input. Depending on which guna is more dominant, you will decide. You get the idea? They keep changing moment to moment, not just through the day. They can change every moment.
So what's an ideal?
Ideal is what they what they call. Now, the term they use is balance. Okay? Balance. There's no way to define that balance. It'll be very individual. But if the gunas are balanced, that means they are not fluctuating then. They remain the same. Then you can attain a state which they call gunatit. That means now you can transcend these gunas and go beyond them. That's the ultimate state of samadhi or kaivalya. When you can transcend the gunas, that's called the gunatit in Sanskrit. Beyond the gunas. Atit means beyond.
Past.
Beyond.
Yes.
Not
before
A samadhi implies the balance of the gunas. Ultimate state of samadhi implies balance of the gunas. There's no feelings here, no. Feelings are related, feelings are considered to be a part of the ego. Okay? And we are getting past the ego with all these things. Feelings are based on judgment. Judgment is decided by the ego. We are talking of things which are beyond the ego, beyond feelings. In Bhagavad Gita, they call it samatva bhava. Have you heard the term samatva bhava in Gita? That's called, in English they call it equanimity. That means there's no feelings. Feelings is either positive or negative, good or bad. Feelings is you're favoring something, you have a judgmental situation there. We're going past that. it's a state which is beyond that judgmental state. I like it, I dislike it. That's feeling, right? Why I like the situation. I don't like it. I hate it. I love it. That's all ego. We want to go beyond that. Can we ever do that? I don't know. We can try. Okay. Is everyone okay so far? So, five states. Kshipta is the state which is totally controlled by rajas and tamas. It means fully scattered mind, completely helter-skelter, you know, mind is going here, there, everywhere, every moment is changing. That's the mind which we are normally in most of the time. We cannot fix the mind on anything at any given time. That's kshipta. Mudha is that very dull state that I talked about, which is totally dominated by tamas. Very dull. Okay. Then vikshipta, now we are getting a little bit of the feeling of sattva in there. So it's a state of the mind which is dominated by sattva and rajas. Vikshipta means the mind is able to stay focused for a small amount of time maybe. But it is partially scattered, but partially can get into a state of focus. So when you sit for meditation, for example, and you have meditated for some length of time, some means you have been practicing for several months maybe, and you have developed the ability to stay calm for a short amount of time, that's the vikshipta state. Okay? When you get a feel that, okay, oh, my mind was quiet, even for a fleeting moment, that's the vikshipta state. Now when you deepen your meditation or when you are able to focus on something very deeply, then you get into the ekagra state. Ekagra means now you are able to focus on one thing at a given time for an extended period of time. One-pointedness, as they call it. Ekagra state. Okay? And when you can go past that ekagra state and completely suppress any eruption from the subconscious level. Nothing comes up from the subconscious level to distract your mind. That's called the niruddha state. Completely, totally restrained. That means I have mastered the ability to not be bothered by anything that can come up from the subconscious level. Nothing. Nothing will come up. So I put my subconscious level to permanent sleep, so to say. That's the deepest state of samadhi, called niruddha state. That's where the Patanjali is using the next term, which I'm going to come to now. Okay, so when the mind, when the three gunas are not in equilibrium, that's the disturbed mind. All right, so that was number one, sutra. Is that understood? Atha, let's all repeat that. Atha, yoga anushasanam. The whole sentence. Atha yoga anushasanam. So now having understood the background to this yoga sutras, the next statement is the very definition of yoga. That's the sutra number 2. So again, repeat after me. Yogash,
yogash
chitta,
chitta
vritti,
vritti
nirodha.
Nirodha.
One more time, one word at a time. Yogash,
yogash
chitta,
chitta
vritti,
vritti
nirodha.
Nirodha.
And now the whole sentence. Yogash chitta vritti nirodha.
Yogash chitta vritti nirodha.
Good. So now there are 4 words in this sentence. And we need to understand each word one by one. Right? The meaning of this sentence, if I were to make an English sentence around these 4 Sanskrit words, the English sentence would sound like this. Yoga, by definition, is the nirodha of the vrittis that appear in the chitta. That's the English sentence made with Sanskrit words. Yoga, by definition, is the nirodha of the vrittis appearing in the chitta. Okay? So keeping that in mind, we need to understand what these 4 words mean. Chitta, what's chitta?
Mind.
Chitta is the mind. Mind, the broad mind, you know, the broader perspective of the mind. We'll talk about that. So then we can replace chitta with the word mind in English. What's the vritti?
Fluctuations. Disturbances.
Disturbances, fluctuations, changes, constant modifications, perturbations, any number of words can be placed there for the translation of vrittis. Okay? And what's nirodha? Control, cessation, subduing, is that a good noun? It's not a noun, right? Subduing is a noun. I'm looking for a noun for that word.
Subdue
is a verb.
Also a noun.
No. Subdue?
We'll take it.
Subduction.
Sometimes I get stuck with some of these English words I don't know. So yoga, by definition, is the ability to control or calm the fluctuations or constant changes or modifications that are going on in the mind. And like we said, because of these 3 gunas, the mind is constantly undergoing change. Because the gunas are undergoing change, therefore the mind is undergoing change. And there's constant modifications, changes going on. Every moment a thought comes, and immediately a next thought follows. Sometimes related, most of the time related, but many times totally unrelated thoughts. Right? But that's what's happening in the mind. So why is it that we want to calm the mind? What's the problem with the mind undergoing these fluctuations? Why do we need to? Why are we interested in that? That's the question.
So that the ego isn't controlling the responses or reactions.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, very simplistically. If there, say that again.
To stay calm and happy constantly.
For what that implies is when the mind is not calm, when there are fluctuations, it's not happy. Is that the implication?
There's a correlation. I don't know if there's a causation.
I mean, I think about it as taking control of it rather than just going with the flow.
What's wrong with going with the flow?
Because. So ego, essentially, if you go with the flow of the ego,
takes over.
Yeah. So you define what.
So
you
now we're trying to get a little more deeper into this whole thing as to what's happening in the mind, right? What's causing these fluctuations, and once we know what is causing all these changes, then we will have a better idea why do we want to control the mind. Otherwise, we may say, oh, it's okay. If the mind is changing, so what? No. That change. Right? But when these changes come, all the actions are controlled by the mind. With these changes, that means we are not able to focus on anything because now we want to do this action, then suddenly we want to do the opposite action because the mind keeps changing. Thoughts, behavior patterns, emotions keep changing. So with these changes, a lot of other things change which are totally undesirable. That's why we want to learn how to calm the mind, or why to calm the mind. Right? So the purpose of yoga then is to learn how to calm all the fluctuations, the changes, perturbations that keep going from moment to moment, so that we can stay calm and peaceful, as you said. Calm and peaceful. Right? So now to learn how to calm or control something, you need to understand that entity. So if you're talking about the mind, we need to understand what the mind is all about. So let's try to understand the mind. Okay. So again, to understand the mind, you know, these yogis have told us that it's a good idea to think of the mind as a composite of four functions. All right. And the illustration that I'm going to give you, actually I got inspired by the illustration given by Swami Satchidananda. So I've kind of extended it a little more to make it more understandable. So he says that think of the mind as a composite of four functions. So this is the mind. Then the four functions that the mind does. What are the things that mind does? What's happening in the mind?
Think.
Then the second is intellect.
Memory
is number three. Ego is number four. So these are the four basic categories in which the mind can be described as the functions of the mind. Okay? The thinking capability, it's also called the cognitive function, cognition. Cognition implies that you are able to cognize stuff coming in from the five senses. That's one, cognition. The other cognition is that whatever erupts out of the memory, you can cognize that. Okay, so two ways you can get stuff into the mind, through the five senses or eruptions from the memory, subconscious levels. Thinking also, you know, this cognition also kind of includes everything like I have a will, I have a desire to do this thing, and I'm worried to do, you know, all those little things, emotional things also, they kind of club all that into this thinking function. All right. What's intellect?
Decision making.
Analysis, decision making, all that stuff. So this part of the mind in Sanskrit, again, we need to know the Sanskrit names also. That's called manas. M-A-N-A-S, manas, thinking mind. The intellect is called
buddhi.
Memory is called
Smriti.
Oops. I'll start writing in Sanskrit. Smriti, it's also called Chitta. That's another word for memory. This whole complex is also called the Chitta. Okay? So this whole complex is called the Chitta. But the memory part is also called chitta. What's ego called in Sanskrit? Ahankara. That everyone knows that. Okay. Ahankara. So that's the four major functions of this mind, or called what's called the chitta. And how do they all function together? That's the story that I have taken from Swami Sachidananda. Okay, so it's a very interesting made-up story. So the way it goes is that you at the end of the day you're coming back from your work maybe, you know, and by the end of the day you're kind of a little bit hungry. So your natural tendency is to walk into the kitchen or towards this. As soon as you get close to the kitchen, you start smelling something. So the first, this cognition kicks in. Okay, you start cognizing things. And the first cognition that happens is the sense of smell. So you're able to smell something nice. And then you're drawn to that smell. And as soon as you reach the kitchen, on the countertop, you see this little piece of cake sitting there. So now your sense of sight is engaged. You are able to see that cake. And then, as soon as you see that cake, your tendency is to engage the sense of touch, because you want to dip your finger, feel its texture and what it feels like. And as soon as that happens, you want to put it on your tongue so you can get the sense of taste engaged. So having done all that, you have all the basic information about this cake. And then it is decision time, because they always have two options, or more than two options in most cases. And in this case, simple options are?
Eat
or not to eat, right? So, and who is the decision maker? Who is the?
Ego.
Intellect. Supposedly, right? The main purpose of intellect is to make the decisions. So, in computer language, I always like the computer language in this case, there's a function call made, right?
CPU.
Function call CPU, right? With all the parameters, which are all these senses, the function is transferred to another function, which is called the intellect, for making a decision. Okay? Now, in our current state, like Nila said, you know, the unfortunate situation is that the intellect is unable to make decisions independently. It is under the control of the ego. The ego is the boss at this time. Because the ego is the boss, intellect has to approach the ego. Hey, boss, knock, knock, what do I do in this case? This is what the information is. So, now, all the decisions are made based on the memory. Every decision has to be based on something in the memory. Otherwise, we have no way of deciding anything. Because in memory, there is a storehouse of all the previous experiences of life. Right? So the ego says, okay, let me go into the memory. Of course, it goes into the memory and pulls out another instance about a week or 10 days ago, where it says, I had the same cake. And then always the ego likes to put a label, as you probably know, that whatever happens in life, you put a label. Good, bad, ugly, handsome, you know, like, dislike, lovely, not so lovely, terrible, etc., etc., right? We put these labels. So when it went to that cake, which was, you know, which we had about a week or 10 days ago, the label there was divine. That experience was the most delightful experience, unparalleled divine experience. And based on that label, the ego says that the decision is very simple. It told the intellect, go tell the mind to activate the motor actions, you know, extend the hand, do whatever you need to do. You know what the actions are. So when it comes back to the intellect says, huh, I am the intellect. I need to do my private investigation in any case. I know my boss says what I have to do, but let me just dig into the memory one more time. Goes into the memory, and somewhat related incidents where what it says was that we went to the doctor recently, about 7 days, 6 days ago. And based on the blood work, my cholesterol levels came out to be dangerously high. Dangerously high, very high cholesterol. And the doctor immediately wanted me to go to a nutritionist, dietitian, so I can control my diet. I did that. And guess what the dietitian said?
No
cake. No cake.
No divine stuff.
No divine stuff. So now the poor intellect is very highly alarmed. Look, my boss says that I have to eat this cake, but I'm not supposed to. So he goes back and runs back to the boss. Boss, guess what I found? I'm not supposed to eat the cake. My cholesterol levels are high. Guess what the boss says?
Eat it.
Just one piece.
Just a bite.
He says, are you a stupid idiot? Don't you see the label? The label says divine and you're telling me not to eat it? How can you be so stupid? All right. So that's how the mind functions, right? That's the main manner in which the mind functions in every situation in life. This is just one related to eating, but it happens in every situation, whether it's related to work, family, kids, spouse, it doesn't matter.
So the intellect always goes to ego for...
Currently, that's the whole problem. That's the problem situation, because the intellect is now accustomed to go to the ego because we have given this responsibility to the ego instead of the intellect. So that's right, yes. And the purpose of yoga, according to Patanjali, is to transfer this control from the ego over to the intellect again. So the intellect becomes the boss and ego becomes a subservient to the intellect. That's the purpose of the practice of yoga.
So there's no analysis part that ego does at all?
Ego did the analysis. It went to the memory and it found the analysis was done by the ego that it's a great thing to do. The best thing ever that happened, so my analysis is, yes, go ahead and do it again. The point is, Pani, that we want the analysis to be done by the intellect, not by the ego. That's the whole point. Right? So the purpose of yoga is to transfer this power from the ego over to the intellect. Okay. So yoga by definition is to develop the ability to calm the fluctuations, calm the changes that are going on in the mind. That's the definition of yoga. Okay. Cognitive mind, intellect, ego, storage, memories, impressions, unfulfilled desires. Now, the modifications, as I mentioned, they are all caused by the three gunas. That's the statement here. Sattva, rajas and tamas. That's what we talked about. All right. And like I said, to create that balance, complete balance, is the control that we're talking about. Nirodha means that you are able to get into back into the state of balance between the three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas.
Can you explain that one line? When the intellect takes the form, same form as the object perceived, it's called.
So what happened is, every perception, right, is based on either a thought or some object that comes to the mind or some one of the five senses, whatever happens, right? Now, when the intellect is only concerned about that, that becomes a vritti then. It's the form of the shape of the mind at that point. Okay, and then you're only worried about that. But then it changes the very next moment. Then the intellect changes its shape.
Is it a good thing to be like that?
It's a good thing to be for the intellect to be able to stay on one and not be bothered by anything else coming in. That's meditation.
Okay.
But right now it's fluctuation all the time. Because the different objects are coming in, and intellect is changing its shape to conform to those objects constantly. So what happens then when we are able to keep the mind under control, then what happens? Tada drashtuhu swarupe avasthanam. Tada drashtuhu swarupe avasthanam. Now when you read it all together, tada drashtuhu swarupe vasthanam. Now when you read these two final words together, that a is not pronounced finally, so it becomes swarupe vasthanam. That's Sanskrit. You don't pronounce that final, you know, that beginning a when you combine these two. Okay? What does this sentence mean now? What does it say? It says the seer rests in its own true nature. What is the seer, or who is the seer?
Soul.
Purusha. Right now, the situation is, as we said, that the Purusha is confusing itself with the ego. It doesn't know its true identity. It doesn't know who it is, who he is, Purusha. Now, that happens because the mind is totally fluctuating because of the three gunas being dominant, one at a time. Ego takes over, and ego takes advantage of this confusion in the mind. It says, okay, I'm glad that you guys are confused. I know what to do. I can take over now. But when we are able to calm the mind to a point that there are no fluctuations in the mind, things straighten out. Then the ego has nothing to work on, because ego works on those past impressions called samskaras. And when they become ineffective, then the ego doesn't have much to do, therefore intellect takes over. When the intellect takes over, it knows finally exactly that my boss is not the ego, but this pure Purusha, on whose consciousness I am dependent upon now. And that's what it says, that when the mind is calm, when I'm able to attain that state of Nirodha, Chitta Vritti Nirodha, when I'm able to attain that state, then seer. Why is it called the seer? Because the goal of the Purusha, or the role of Purusha, is just to observe. It doesn't get involved in anything. But it needs to be an independent observer and enjoy whatever is the experience being given by the Prakriti. And to do that, it has to sit in its own true nature and not be confused by the ego. Okay, it's a little complicated topic, but I hope you get some sense of it. All right? Kalpana?
One quick question. So, where's the Purusha sitting? Is it behind the mind?
Purusha? All right, let me see if I can draw a picture. Hold on a second. Let me see what's the best way to draw a picture. Let's see this. So, let me call this the mind. Let's call this the memory. I'm just going to put some boxes here, see if it makes sense. Intellect, ego, five senses, so these are arrows this way, and these are arrows outward. I didn't call it motor action. Does everyone know what I mean by motor action? Right. Okay. And the mind is connected to the ego, so this is this whole complex, we called it the chitta. And the five senses are connected to the mind for cognition, and then these motor actions, your hands, feet and all that, they can act based on what the mind provides the instructions. Then, so the mind gets all the input, and then it sends the information to the intellect. Intellect doesn't know what to do, so it goes to the ego. Hey boss, tell me what I should do. Ego will look into the memory, pull out stuff, tells the intellect to guide the mind accordingly. Okay, intellect does its own investigation. It goes into the memory itself, okay, and finds out whatever it has to do, and then goes back to the ego, and then eventually tells the mind whatever it needs to do. So far, okay? Okay, and then, as you can think of this as a small curtain here, beyond which the Purusha sits. They have to be together or close to each other, but are separate. Now, in the current state of the mind, this Purusha is confused by the ego because, you know, there's so much going on. The Purusha doesn't know its true identity, therefore the ego takes over, and everyone else thinks that ego is the main boss. They don't know the true reality. So the whole idea of all this is to diminish the influence of this and enhance the influence of this so that the Purusha can become perfectly independent, not bothered by anything else. It becomes the pure seer then. Does that picture make sense then? Okay.
So I think of this... An analogy that comes to my mind is like I have a 6-year-old twin boys who would like they act like ego, throwing tantrums when they want chocolate. And then they already had one and they want five more or whatever, and they just keep crying. And either you give up and essentially follow their will, or you know what is the right thing. So that's the confusion.
Well, we do not know. We can only talk about us. Okay, we cannot say that kids are based on doing their ego or their ego is involved or whatever.
No, I mean, I'm just bringing an analogy. That's the conflict.
I understand that. What I'm saying is, you can only decide whether your ego is involved in that or not.
Okay.
Not whether the kid's ego is involved
sure.
or not. First, you know, Patanjali talks about my mind. It's what's happening in my mind. It doesn't talk too much about somebody else's mind. Okay? Now, are you able to handle the situation purely based on your intellect, or is your ego involved when you want to handle that situation? That's all Patanjali is interested in. Okay?
So what happens as we start sitting in meditation, for example, right?
and then we bring in that single point of focus, or we are you're jumping
way ahead. No, the reason is because that's a topic of discussion which I spend almost 3 sessions on that topic. What happens during meditation and how is it able to calm the mind, how is it, what's happening? We spend almost 3, maybe actually we spend more than 3 sessions on that. I cannot condense that into 2 minutes for this discussion. Yeah, but this short answer is yes. Whatever your question is, the answer is yes.
No, my question was what? So maybe something happens, we will learn about it later.
Yes.
What are you saying is control your ego.
No, it's not the ego.
No.
Mistranslation.
No.
The question, it's a good question. I understand what you're saying. Her question is, how is meditation able to do what we are asking us to do? Basically, is that the question? What's meditation doing for us?
I'm more interested in what happens to that purusha when I'm in meditation state.
Right. So that's a question that we cannot answer in a short time frame. Just wait.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We'll get there. That's a deep question and it will take some more time. But is that so far, is that okay? Tada drashtuhu swarupe vasthanam. That means when we are able to calm the mind, then the purusha, the seer, can rest in its own true self, in its own true nature. That means it has been able to disengage itself from the ego. It has been able to disengage. It's not confused anymore. Okay? And therefore, it is able to sit and rest comfortably. But if you don't do that, so then when the mind's fluctuations are controlled, Sankhya philosophy says Purusha and Prakriti, seer is the Atma, etc., etc., total Kaivalya. We've talked about all this, right? So I don't need to dwell on that. Okay, so you can control the mind. When you can control the mind, you are able to sit in your own true nature. If that doesn't happen, okay, then the next statement is vritti sarupyam itaratra. Vritti sarupyam itaratra. Vritti sarupyam itaratra. What does that mean now? Vritti is what we said is the fluctuations that are constantly going on in the mind, right? Changes that are constantly going on in the mind. That's vritti. What does the word sarupyam mean?
Similarity.
Oneness. So, what it says is, itaratra means otherwise. Itaratra means otherwise, on the other hand. So one situation is when you're able to calm the mind. And in that case, the seer or the purusha is aware of itself, of its own nature. Otherwise, if you're not able to calm the mind, then the seer takes on the shape of the vritti.
It's carried away.
It's carried away by the constant flow of thoughts, and the ego takes over and all that thing happens. So basically, in a nutshell, the statements are, hey guys, look, you have 2 choices. Either you calm the mind and become free forever, okay? Or you don't calm the mind, you don't take control of the mind, let the mind control you then. So either you take charge of the mind or the mind will take charge of you and take you for a ride all the time. What do you want? Right? That's the choices that Patanjali is giving us. Either you calm the mind and take charge, okay, or if you don't calm the mind, then whatever is happening in the mind, which is controlled by the ego, will take charge.
one of the implications of this statement is that when the seer rests on its own true nature, it breaks those identifications with the mind stuff.
That's right.
That's the freedom it's talking about.
Yes.
So you're no longer identifying with...
with the mind, with the body, with what's happening in the mind. Absolutely, yes. That's the freedom we want.
So I remember, in a similar context, what I learned recently was self-awareness. The way it was defined is the ability, in a way, to see yourself in slow motion all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, kind of detaching yourself.
Yes. That's a good way of putting it.
Mind, body and emotions.
Good way of putting it. It's slow motion awareness. Yeah. It's very good. Okay. Any questions so far? This is the definition of yoga, basically. So far, these four statements tell us the definition of yoga. All right. Now, the next, it moves to the... oh, you can just read this quickly. This is what we have already talked about. If there's any question that comes to mind after reading that, let me know. Otherwise... and move on. Everyone okay with these statements? Right? Anything that comes to mind, do let me know. Now, Patanjali talks, the next few sutras he devotes to understanding what the vrittis are, what's called a vritti and what causes them and all that. Okay, what are the vrittis? So the statement here is vrittayaha panchatayaha klishta aklishtaha. So vrittayaha panchatayaha klishta aklishtaha. So when you read the whole sentence, vrittayaha panchatayaha klishta aklishtaha. Good. You know, as a bonus of learning, you know, this Yoga Sutra, you're also getting a lesson in Sanskrit. You know, I was telling somebody, this is one of the benefits that I received through my study of Sanskrit, is that now I'm able to at least get my own interpretation of the sutras. I don't have to entirely depend on the commentators. They put a lot of salt and pepper of their own, you know. But now I am able to kind of put my own two cents into every sutra and develop my own understanding. It has really been a great help to me in understanding these a little bit deeper. Otherwise, you have no idea, you know, and they just read the translation and whatever the translation says, you depend on it. And if you read, you know, on my blog, if you go there, I have translations by 7 authors. And for each sutra, every translation is different by each of these authors for the same sutra. No two translations are identical. So who do you depend on? You just have to depend on them then, whoever you pick. Okay, so the vrittis, it says, are in 5 categories. Panchatayaha means 5 categories. There are 5 categories of vrittis. And they are either klishta. Klishta means?
Bad.
Painful.
Bad.
Klishta means painful. Klishta means which cause suffering, pain. And aklishta means? Not painful. Not painful. Ak means no pain. A is a prefix which says no.
Negative.
Negative, right?
Those words related to klishas? Are those words related to klishas?
Yes. They are related to klesha. They all come from the root word klish. Klish is the root word. From that klesha comes, and klishta is the same thing. Very good observation. You are a good candidate to learn Sanskrit quickly.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's kind of like the mother tongue, isn't it?
Huh?
Sanskrit, the mother tongue.
Well, that's what people claim, right? Yeah, there are This gentleman is associated with Sanskrit Bharati that teaches Sanskrit. You can check with him or I can give you some references if you are ever interested. Okay. So, there are five categories of these vrittis or of these fluctuations or changes or modifications of the mind. And these could be either of the category of klishta, which means painful or causing negative emotions or thoughts, or aklishta, not quite painful. All right. See, there it goes. Same thing. Painful vrittis are caused by kleshas. And we will be talking about kleshas in the second chapter. We're not going to spend time on that here when we move on next, okay? And these are leading to accumulation of karma and continuous bondage. Again, I don't want to get into the discussion of karma and all because that's all second chapter. If I start now, you know, we'll be digressing too far then. Okay, so just read these sentences for what they are worth. And then we'll be getting into the details of karma theory and kleshas, and that's all part of chapter 2 discussion. Okay? Any questions on these? Does everyone understand everything thoroughly?
Samskaras is quite the same as memory.
Okay, samskaras are the memories which have received a label.
Good, bad.
Like it, dislike it, painful, not so painful, love it, hate it.
So made by the ego?
Hmm?
Is it created by the ego?
Yes. You know, so to understand that concept, there are three things mentioned, right? As a part of this memory bank, can I erase this? Well, I'm trying to remember scalars and vectors. Not quite the same, you know. There's no coloring in the scalars and vectors. It's a quality, right?
With a direction. So
yeah, direction. But this is more than direction. It's a coloring, labeling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if I need a better. Eraser or better board or something. Or a more powerful hand, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, maybe that might help. Okay, so there are, you know, whenever we have an experience, it will lodge a memory, right, in our mind, chitta, as they call it. So there are three categories of memories that are mentioned in our text, scriptures. And the way they're described is, so there is the pure memory, let me call it the pure memory, okay? I'm talking of an experience. So, pure memory is called smriti. What do I mean by pure memory? No colors, no labels attached. Okay? So if you're If this meeting that we are having today creates a pure memory, that will be, this meeting was held in such and such date, it was at such and such time, so many people were there, who were the instructor, and this and that. That's pure memory.
Bland, raw data.
Raw data. Okay. Now, the second is called samskara. Now, this is where you have put salt and pepper on your memory. You have labeled it good, bad, I like it, I dislike it, I hate it, whether it was nice, pleasant or unpleasant, painful or not so painful. All that is a part of this samskara now. So, in English you can call it impression. Good impression, bad impression, right? That kind of stuff. Impression. Okay? The third part is called, in Sanskrit it's called, Vasana. What does vasana mean?
Attachment.
Vasana literally means that you are now desire. It's a kind of a subliminal desire for something. Right? Vasana. That means?
Longing.
Yes. All those words that you use are okay. The idea is how to understand these things, right? So now, we have a samskar, you know, and that was, if I like it, I'll put a label, liked it. If I dislike it, same label. Along with that, there is also another label put, whether I would like a repeat of this experience, or I would never want that experience in my life again. That is called vasana. Okay, subliminal desire which links to my situation, which is samskara, whether I would like to just do this again or I would never want to do this again. That's called vasana. That's why it's called attachment. If I'm attached to it, you know, I want it again.
If I attend, then I will do it.
Yes.
If I not,
then I will not want to do it. That's vasana.
So we come back with those vasanas? The soul comes back with its vasanas?
Everything. It comes back with samskaras, memories, everything.
The samskaras as
well. Everything. It comes back with all this baggage.
Not the soul. The soul doesn't come back with it.
Sure. That's the whole idea. If the soul didn't come back, then it is liberated. Then you are finalized. Then you're done. Yeah. It's the soul which is attached to all this. That's the whole problem. That's the reason we have rebirth. If the soul was detached from all this, no rebirth.
Done.
Then we're done. I'm home. Then we won't be here. I'm just kidding. But you get the idea, right? Why did I get into this discussion?
I asked you a question. It's an impression.
Impression on this. He's asking about the
samskara. Oh, samskara. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, So what it says is samskaras are the intangible and inactive state of vrittis, and vrittis are tangible and active outcome of samskaras. That's one of the ways vrittis happen in the mind, is to like I said, things come up from the memory, okay? They were previously in the deep subconscious level, subliminal levels. Now they come active. They become active into the active state of the mind. When that active state of the mind, whatever is happening, that's called the vritti. You get the idea?
It's both, right? It's both samskaras as well as vasanas.
Yeah. We normally, they don't distinguish. In the normal parlance, you always say just samskaras. You don't say and vasanas. You don't have to do that. It's implied. I just made a difference because we want to understand the details. Normally they don't distinguish between them.
Like at the end of the yoga practice, you always have us do that to set an intention and repeat it in our minds 3 times. So we are basically imprinting into our mind.
What do we say? Can you repeat that?
Think of something positive, a samskara. Am I saying that right?
No. When do we say?
Sankalpa, thank you.
Hmm?
To set an intention.
Just think of it as sankalpa.
Sankalpa, yeah.
But that's setting those imprints into the mind.
Yes.
Positive.
Yes. A very good observation.
Yeah.
That's the idea. That when we say that sankalpa, because at that time the mind is already very receptive. We have already quietened it to a certain extent, and it's receptive for those impressions to be put in the mind, sankalpa. So these samskaras are good samskaras, and they can eventually help us overtake or overcome some of the poor or the bad samskaras.
It's like past and future, right? I mean, the breath impressions, like sankalpa, you're intentionally making that impression to happen that you want to happen.
Yes.
And then samskara is something that has happened that you're experiencing. That's
right.
What you do with it, how you deal with it.
You're making a deposit into the positive side.
Positive side of the whole bank balance, yes. That's right.
But in this fourth, the third one, the vrittis are tangible. I think they're meant by actions, like by impressions. You know, if we say this, for example, like we think snakes are going to bite, so the tangible vritti is the outcome, like run away.
Fear.
Yeah.
That's the vritti, which will make you run away.
Right.
That's very good, yes. Very good.
What is it again? Vritti?
No, tangible. What's vritti is something that is on this active state of the mind, and vritti is what is going to actually cause action. So what she's saying is that if you see a snake on the road, the vritti caused by that is fear, and the fear that fear is going to cause the action which is running away from that spot.
So vritti is equivalent to action.
No, vritti is the cause of action. Vritti is what's happening in the mind. Fear is the vritti.
Okay.
The impression that we have
in the mind.
Activity in the mind, yes. Action is caused by that.
Right.
Is the result of that vritti. Okay. So, vrittayaha, panchatayaha, klishta, klishtaha. 5 categories of vrittis. Okay, what are these 5 categories? Actually, it's time to stop. I just realized the time. Okay, so at this point, I'd like to ask if there are any questions. Otherwise, you can just sign in your names. I think I should have everybody's email address, so you don't need to give me your email address. Just sign in your name, everybody. Any other thoughts that come to mind? Yes.
You mentioned that Purusha, like when ego takes over, Purusha was confused by different bad or good feelings. But I was under the impression that Purusha is it's untouchable. He doesn't have any...
In the pure state, it is untouchable. In the pure state. It's not in the pure state. That's the whole problem. See, right now...
So actually, the clean Purusha is...
Always clean.
Right. It's clouded by all these... ego.
Ego and all the impressions that we have. It's clouded by that.
Once you clear that, then Purusha will be able to see everything in natural state.
It's in a natural state.
But... at that point, it's not influenced by ego or...
At that point, it won't be. Once it is clarified, once it is cleansed out of all the impurities, then it will not be influenced by the ego.
But once it's cleanse, you said, but a purusha is always cleanse.
See, it's always clean, but we don't know that. That's the point. The problem is we don't know it's always clean. We believe, because of the influence of the ego, that it is the ego which is dominating everything. We don't even know the existence of purusha. Purusha by itself is very clean and pure, yes, but do we know that? We don't know the existence of the purusha. We are driven by the ego all the time.
You mentioning about one of the sutras, I think a couple of months ago, I think related to this topic was, it is as if we are wearing a clouded goggles or something.
Yes.
So the purusha is not able to see clearly, is cloudy, and if you can remove those goggles, that's right. What this is.
No, I was confused where, as per the explanation, purusha was influenced by this.
It's hard to put these things into words. Mm-hmm. Confusion is going to remain because we don't know what reality is.
So these are all abstract things.
These are abstract things. We are trying to put words around whatever we understand is the situation. Okay, I think the closest way we can say is the ego is the master at this point. It does not want anybody to know there is a purusha which is independent. That's the whole point. Because it likes that power. Because ego likes to dip into the memory, it's dipping into the samskaras and the vasanas and act on based on that. It will do only what it likes, not what is good for us. And that's where the problem is.
If the purusha is pure, why does it get clouded by the ego?
Ego. That's chapter 2. That's called avidya. Avidya is ignorance. And they say, according to these philosophies, avidya is beginningless. There is no beginning to it. We were born with that avidya. And therefore we were born with that confusion. And that's the start of chapter 2. I mean, Patanjali covers all these topics.
It's like the human condition. It's the human condition. Like you said, we're born that way. It's the human condition.
Human condition.
Yeah. People are born in ignorance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You don't know.
That's the human condition,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.